Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, he's his own worst enemy. This is 1 Samuel 21 and 22. Have you ever known someone that is their own worst enemy? It's like you can have everything you want if you just get out of your own way. It's like everything, you're just sabotaging yourself every second. That's what Saul is doing to himself. God wanted him to be the king of Israel, and he gave him David, who was going to lift his spirits whenever he was down, who was going to be a great warrior for him. He could have been the king of Israel, and he could have had great success through David, his servant, but instead, he just couldn't get out of his own way. He was trying to hold on to his own power so tightly that he ended up losing his power. And that can happen to all of us. If we don't recognize who gave us these great gifts in the first place and release them to him, entrust our lives to him, then we can risk losing it all. So if you'll remember on our last episode, Saul has decided that he's going to kill David. And so David is on the run. And that's where we pick up in chapter 21 this week. When he left the place where the king was staying, then he took shelter in the land of Nob. And this is a town that is between Bethlehem and Gibeah, and it is where the priestly town resided after Shiloh was destroyed. Shiloh was the priestly city until the high priest and his sons did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and God killed all three of them. So Eli and his sons Hophni and Phinehas, all three died on the same day, and the city was destroyed. But Phinehas had a son, and his son Ahimelech was the priest of Nob whenever David ran there. And so Ahimelech sees David. He knows exactly who he is because he's been there multiple times with the king's servants. But he doesn't see the whole entourage as he normally does. And so he's like worried. What is going on? Why is David here by himself? And David lies to the priest and he says, I've been sent here on a secret mission. And then he goes on to tell the king, and I left in such a hurry that I don't have any provisions for my journey. And so we are hungry now. And so I wonder if maybe you have some food for us. And the priest is like, well, I don't have any food that I'm supposed to be giving to just ordinary men. The only food that I have here is the showbread, but that is meant only for the priests. They're the only persons that are supposed to eat it. But maybe because you've been sent on a mission by the king, and because you're hungry, and because we're supposed to be eating this bread today anyway. It's supposed to be exchanged out. The way that it would work is that the bread would sit on the table in the temple until for a week, and then every week it was changed out. And when it was changed out, the priests would eat it. And so he's like, it's time for us to eat it anyway. You're not normally supposed to eat it, but if you meet all the requirements of the priests, like, you know, you're clean and all of those things, then I guess I could give you our bread in order for you to have some food. So David took the bread and ate it and gave it to the people that were there with him. David told the priest, also left in such a hurry that I didn't have time to grab my sword. Do you happen to have a sword here for me? And he was like, well, the only sword that we have is the sword that you used to kill Goliath, Goliath's sword. It's wrapped up in memory of our victory in the battle here in the temple. But since you're the one that used it to kill him anyway, then yeah, sure, I can give you that sword. And then after David got the sword, we find out that one of Saul's herdsmen is also there in the temple. So he sees David. But he doesn't know anything's going on between Saul and David, so he doesn't tell on him. So this servant is there to make a vow to God. But he's a foreigner from the tribe of Esau, who has adopted God as his own God and follows Jewish law. And so he's there to make this vow to God, but presumably he got stuck there at the temple because he didn't have time to travel back to his land before the Sabbath. The rule was that you could not travel on the Sabbath because that was considered too much work, and they're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And so he is stuck there and can't travel. David is arriving just as the Sabbath day is approaching. So they're both there at the same time. And then the showbread is replaced on the Sabbath, and now he's able to eat it. And so we learn that they see each other, but he doesn't say anything. He doesn't give him away because he doesn't know anything's going on with them. And then David takes the sword and goes on his way. And he decides that he's going to hide in the land of Gath, which is in the land of the Philistines, which is a great place to hide if you are hiding from the king of Israel, you know, hide in the land of his enemies because he's never going to look for you there. But it's not the greatest place to hide if you don't want to be killed by your enemies, which you've been fighting against all of this time, right? And so some of the people recognize David and they bring him to the king. And when David realizes, oh no, they're going to realize that I'm the one that's been fighting against them this entire time and they're going to kill me, he pretends to be crazy. And so he is, they say, you know, drawing on the gate like he doesn't know what's going on and he's drooling and he looks like a crazy person. And the king falls for it. He's like, yeah, this guy's no threat to me. He's lost his mind. No wonder he's in our land. You know, he doesn't know what's going on. And so he's like, yeah, he's not a threat to me, but I've got enough crazy people in my own city. I don't need one in my own house. And so he sends David away. And then David goes to the land of Judah and hides in the cave of Adullam. Well, at this point, his family realizes where he is, and they go to join him. And then word gets out, and a lot of people begin to join him, people who are also running from the king or who are just outcasts. They don't feel seen or heard by the king of Israel, and they want to follow David instead. They feel like he cares about them, and maybe King Saul doesn't care about them, and so they become his followers. Well, in the meantime, David is like, I'm worried for my parents. They're going to get caught up in all of this, and I don't want them to get killed because of me. And so he takes his parents to the land of Moab, which the Moabites, they had also been, you know, dealing with some, but it wasn't so much of a fight between the Moabites as the Moabites just wanted to control them. And so he's like, I think I can trust these people with my parents. They're not going to kill them. They're just going to be in control of them and fine by me because right now I can't trust my parents with the king. And so he takes them to the land of Moab and entrusts them to the king of Moab. And then he goes back to the cave and he stays there until the prophet Gad says, you need to run to the forest of Judah. And so he does that. Well, in the meantime, Saul has realized, yeah, people have to know where David is by this point. And he calls all of his servants together and he's like, you know, not only do you probably know where he is, but you had to have known about the plot that he had with my son Jonathan to escape. And so what did David promise you in order for you to keep your mouth shut? You know, did he promise to give you fields and vineyards if he killed me and took over? Did he promise to give you military positions? What is it that he promised you? And this is when the foreigner who saw him in the temple, Doge, when he actually says, hey, I actually saw David. You know, I didn't know about this plot, but I saw him in the temple and I saw Ahimelech, the priest, give him food and give him a sword. And so the king summons Ahimelech and all the rest of his family who were also priests to him. And then he addresses him and says, you know, why were you giving food and weapons to my enemy? And the priest is like, what are you talking about, your enemy? He's your most trusted servant. Like, I've seen him here a million times. As far as I knew, what he was telling me was true. He was on a secret mission sent here by you. He's your son-in-law. He has been your best warrior all of this time. And so as far as I'm concerned, he was your most trusted servant. I had no idea that y'all were having any problems. I just assumed that what he told me was true. But Saul doesn't trust him. He doesn't believe the priest. And so he orders that he be killed. But the king's bodyguards are not willing to kill the priest. And so he says, Doja, do it. You do it. Kill him for me. You tattled on him. Now you kill him. And he does. Not only does he kill him, but he kills all the priests. It says 85 priests that day that he kills. So he was willing as a foreigner to do something that the Israelites were not willing to do, right? And then he goes a step further and he goes to that town and he completely wipes it out. It says he devotes it to total destruction, killing every living thing in that town. And only one of Ahimelech's sons survives. And he runs to David and tells David everything that Saul has done. And then David is heartbroken. He's like, oh no, this is all my fault. I saw that guy there and I don't know, I guess I should have done something, but I don't know what it would have been, but this is my fault and I blame myself. And so please, please stay here with me. I will protect you. I feel totally responsible for everything that's happened to your family and I want to be here to protect you. And so Abiathar stays there with David and actually becomes his priest and is his priest for the rest of his life. And so before we move on to our application of this story for ourselves today, I want to just address a couple of issues with this passage. Because a lot of people might be wondering, was David wrong for lying to the priest? And was the priest wrong for giving David the bread, or was David wrong for taking the bread? Because that bread was meant only for the priests. So let's address the lying question first. Was David wrong for lying? Well, the short answer is yes, he never should have lied. But a lot of people believe that that's why the priest got killed, is because of David's lie. But I tend to wonder, and you know, comment and tell me what you think, but I wonder if David wasn't lying to save his own skin. You know, if David would have been lying just because he was afraid, because he was afraid that the priest would tell on him, then obviously, again, it's always wrong, but that would be a different intention. I'm wondering if he wasn't lying to protect the priest, to keep the priest from having to choose between him and the king, because everybody that has chosen David so far, which if the priest knew the whole story, he would have to choose David because Saul is the one who's in the wrong. And everyone that's chosen David so far, the king has been very angry with, but he hasn't killed them because it's his own children. But he would surely kill the priest. So maybe he's trying to protect the priest by not making him make that choice and then giving him plausible deniability whenever, you know, if Saul ever finds out. Maybe that's what David is doing. And so does that make it right if David had good intentions? It doesn't, right? It doesn't make it right. Even though David had good intentions, because he should have trusted that if God had, you know, anointed him as the future king of Israel, then God would have to save his life, right? He can't make him the king if he's dead. And so David should have just trusted that God was going to fulfill his promise, meaning that he would definitely save his life and he wouldn't have to worry about this, and just done what he was supposed to do and trusted God with the outcome. That's what David should have done. But if he wasn't doing it out of his own self-preservation, and he was doing it for the good of the king, then at least it's understandable, and God is forgiving in his weakness. You know, he's not supposed to lie, because Jesus tells the people that Satan is the ultimate liar, right? He is the first deceiver, and he's the one that is deceiving David into thinking that he can't trust God enough to save him, right? And so he is the first deceiver, and anyone that is lying after Satan is just following in Satan's footsteps. And so we're aligning ourselves with Satan instead of with God when we lie. And so it's never okay to do that. But at least, you know, we can think maybe he wasn't wrong on two accounts, right? Lying and having bad intentions for it, you know, trying to save his own skin. Maybe he was at least, you know, trying to not hurt the priest. That is at least something, right? And, you know, maybe I'm wrong on that, but I think that that is a possibility. And so then what about the showbread? Was it wrong for David to take the showbread, or was it wrong for the priest to give it to him? And this is a little more difficult question, because in 1 Samuel 22:10, when Doge is reciting the story to the king, he says that the priest inquired of God and then gave the bread and the sword to David. And that kind of gives the impression that he prayed about it first. Before he gave this to David, he asked God permission. And maybe God gave permission to, you know, forego this normal law for special circumstances. God has the power to do that. And so maybe he did that. Or maybe he just prayed for David like he always prays for David and made the decision on his own. In that case, the king would have been wrong to do that. But in the other case, then David would have just been, again, wrong for lying to him. And so the king is doing it under false pretense, right? And then in Matthew 12, Jesus, whenever the Pharisees are condemning his disciples for making food, is what they say, by walking by and grabbing a head of grain and rubbing it between their hands and popping it in their mouth as they're going about their teaching. When the Pharisees are trying to catch Jesus, you know, doing something wrong on the Sabbath by making food on the Sabbath, working on the Sabbath, then Jesus tells this story about David and how David ate the showbread, breaking Sabbath rules because he was hungry. And he says, you know, you hold David in high esteem, yet you're going to, you know, correct me, the one who made the law in the first place. Like, what are you thinking? The law is made for you. There's a purpose for the law. The law is so that you can rest on the Sabbath. It's not meant to be a burden for you where we can't just grab some grain and pop it in our mouth on the Sabbath. And, you know, David did something much worse than popping it in his mouth, and you don't have a problem with him. So does that mean that Jesus doesn't have a problem with him? Is Jesus saying that it was okay because David did it for a good reason and, you know, we're not supposed to be holding so closely to the letter of the law? Or was he just using it as an example to the people saying, you know, you hold him in high esteem, yet I'm doing something less than him and you're trying to condemn me? What is Jesus doing here? We tend to think that Jesus isn't making a judgment on David one way or the other here. I think he's just using him as an example, and he's not commenting and saying whether he thinks that David was right or wrong, because that's not the point. What he's trying to say is whether he is right or wrong, and he is not wrong. And so I think he's just kind of using it as a point to say to the Pharisees, and he's not giving us an answer one way or the other. And then in the story here in 1 Samuel, he's also not giving us one way or the other a decision on the matter. And so our lesson, I think, here today is not to, you know, focus on something that the writer of the passage nor Jesus himself focuses on, because that's not the focus. The focus is, what is Saul doing wrong? What has Saul been doing wrong, and is he continuing to do wrong all throughout? That is what the real focus is. It has nothing to do with David. And so that's where we're going to place our focus, is on what Saul is doing wrong. Saul was willing not only to kill the priest, but to wipe out the entire priestly town when he wasn't even willing to wipe out the Amalekites when God commanded him to. That command to wipe out every living thing of the town was only given to the worst of offenders. God did not command that in every battle that they had. In a lot of the battles, he told them, hey, just go in and see if the people are willing for you to take over their city and become, you know, part of your nation with you being the ones in charge. And if they are, then you don't even have to fight them. And if they aren't, then you fight them, but you don't kill every living animal and every living person. You only kill the soldiers. And the only people that he said to kill every single person and wipe out the whole town is the towns that were so evil that they had no hope. You know, if he left anyone alive at all, then they were going to come back and continue to fight against him. And that is the command that he gave about the Amalekites, because they were completely evil. And God had promised years ago that he was going to wipe them out. But Saul wouldn't even do that with them. And yet he is willing to do that, not with God's enemies, but with his own enemies, because these priests had done something personal against him, not against God. When it had to do with God's enemies, he was perfectly willing to save some of them. And so this brings us to Saul's wrong all along, right? Is that he has always been more focused on himself than he is on God or on the nation of Israel. And that's why God took the nation away from him, because he's like, you're not focusing on me. You're not carrying things out in the way that I'm asking you to. And you care more about your own power and you know, your own prestige than you do about this nation itself. And that sounds familiar to a lot of us, right, about how we might feel about our own government sometimes, is that they care more about staying in power than they do about their own citizens. That is true of a lot of politicians, and that was true of Saul. And so that's the reason God said, you don't deserve this kingdom. You shouldn't be in charge of these people because you don't care about the people. You care about yourself. And you don't care about me, and so I'm going to take this away from you. And the sad part is that if he would have just obeyed God, he could have kept the kingdom. God wanted to give Saul his kingdom, but he wasn't willing to obey him in order to keep it. And then the sad thing about David is that David was willing to play the harp and lift his spirits anytime that he was feeling down. David also was willing to fight for him and bring him complete victory and success. If he would have only taken David's victory as his own, then he could have accepted it as his own. You know, they were saying that Saul had been a warrior of thousands, but David had been a warrior of tens of thousands. But all Saul would have had to do is say, yeah, but he's fighting on my behalf. You know, I'm the king now, so I don't fight anymore. And so I gave you victory in the beginning. Now David is bringing victory on my behalf for my whole kingdom. And then he could have taken credit for David's victory. That's all he would have had to done. And he could have kept all of it. But instead, he got in his own way, right? He couldn't help himself. He couldn't let David, you know, fight on his behalf. He couldn't follow God's laws. He had to hold on to all of it himself. He had to have complete, total control. Have you ever been in that situation? Have you ever been in a situation where you want to have all the control? You don't want to relinquish any of it to God. You don't want to relinquish any of your, you know, glory to someone else and let them do this, even though it does reflect good on you. You can't even, you know, allow that. That is a temptation for us all at some times when we get into a position of power or, you know, have a little bit of control. Sometimes we don't want to give it up. But the irony is that if he would not have been willing to do all these evil things to keep his power, he would have kept his power. And if he wasn't turning against David, he could have kept David on his side, and then he would have had everything. But instead, he was keeping a hold of all of this, and that was actually making him lose it all. And not only was he losing everything, but David was the one who got everything that he lost. All of his losses were David's gains, because God was taking the kingdom away and giving it to David. And then by turning against David instead of embracing him, then he was forcing the people, including his own children, to take sides, which meant that he was dividing his kingdom at worst and ultimately handing it over to David, because he's making the people take David's side, seeing that David is a great warrior, seeing that David is the one who has been fighting for them, who relates to them, who they've been interacting with, and who is, you know, more on their side. That's how they're seeing him. And so he's forced his own children to take David's side. He's forcing the people to take David's side, all because he wouldn't embrace David. Because he was against David, he made the people against him. And because he wasn't for God, he made God against him. By trying to kill David and by killing the priests, he has pushed some of the people into David's hands already. There are some people already following David, and they'll ultimately be willing to fight for him. So he's, you know, in essence, giving David an army, and he has already given him a priest, because the only priest that is alive is now in David's hand. So he doesn't have anybody who is God's representative on his side anymore. You know, all of the priests and David are on God's side, and he is against him. So he has no one. Even though David doesn't officially have the kingdom yet, everything is going in that direction. You know, the people are beginning to go with David. He's beginning to get an army. He's got a priest already. Everything is going for David and against Saul. And it's all because Saul was trying to hold on to power in any means necessary, right? And that's what happens to all of us. If we are willing to hold on to something by any means necessary, then we risk losing every single bit of it, especially if we're trying to hold on to power and prestige and influence, right? We are risking losing it all. Even great gifts from God can be taken away from us if we are trying to hold them away from him, you know, the one who gave them to us. James 1:17 says that he is the giver of all great gifts. And so he's the one that gave those things to us, and yet we're withholding them from him. Don't expect to be able to hold on to them for very long if you're going to withhold them from the person who gave them to you in the first place. We have to remember who has given us these things if we want to hold on to them. And God told the people this before they ever even entered the promised land. In Deuteronomy 8, beginning in verse 11, he says, "Beware that you don't forget me when you get to this new land." And then he says, "Lest when you have eaten and you are full, and you've built beautiful houses and you dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and everything that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought you water from the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers didn't know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. And then, when you say in your heart," so when you forget that person, that God that did all these things for you, and you say in your heart, "My power and the might of my hand have gained this wealth," you shall remember your God, for he is the one that gives you power to get that wealth. He will establish his covenant before you. So don't forget him, because if you do, then God will testify against you. And just as the nations that God destroyed before you, you will also perish, because you weren't obedient to God's voice. And so don't think for a second that the things that you have are by your own power or by the might of your own hand, because they're not. God has given you every single thing that you have. And so you can't hold on to it so tightly that you hold it away from Him. We have to be willing to give our entire lives up to God. We have to hold on to these things with a very loose hand, because God is the one who is ultimately in control of those things. He's the one who we have to trust our lives with. In Matthew 25, Jesus tells this parable about a man, and it says that the kingdom of heaven is like this. When this man who is in charge of a kingdom, he entrusts his three servants with different amounts of money. And this money is called talents. And so he gives one of his servants five talents, and another two talents, and another one talent. And each one of them goes and invests their talents and gets more, except one that had one talent. And he goes and buries that talent because he doesn't want to risk losing it. And when the ruler of the land comes back, he sees the man that has the five talents, and he's gotten five more talents in this time. And he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with little. Now I will put you in charge of much." And then he sees the one that he gave two talents to, and he's gotten two more, and he tells him the same thing. And then when he gets to the other guy, the one that had one talent, who has buried it, he says, "Why didn't you invest this? If you would have invested this in the bank, then I would at least have what I gave you plus interest. But you were stupid. You didn't spend my money wisely. I entrusted you with something, and you didn't take good care of it. You didn't multiply it. And so I'm going to take away what I gave you, and I'm going to give it to the guy that has 10 talents, because he knows what to do with it." And he ends that passage by saying that anyone who has, more will be given to him, and he will have an abundance. But from him who doesn't have, even what he has will be taken away. Cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. So he's saying, if you don't take care of what I've given you and make profit of it, multiply it, invest it, do what I have given it to you to do with, then I might just take that away from you. And so you can't hold on to your power. You can't hold on to your money. You need to be willing to use that for the reason that I gave it to you. He gave that power to Saul to do on behalf of the people. And if you're not going to use your power for the good of others, then I'm going to take it away. If you're not going to take the money that I gave you and use it for the good of other people, be willing to give of that money, then I'm going to take it away from you. And I'm going to give it to somebody that is going to use it for the benefit of other people. If you're going to be selfish, you're going to try to, you know, keep all of your prestige, and you're going to try to make yourself look good, then I'm not going to allow you to have that prestige. I'm not going to allow you to have that honor. I'm going to let people see you for the selfish person that you are. And I'm going to give that honor to someone that deserves it, someone that's going to be humble, someone that's going to follow me. And so we don't want to be that person, that unprofitable servant that doesn't, take the things that God has given us and use them wisely, that doesn't hold them with a loose hand, that holds them away so tightly that we're our own worst enemy, that what we are so afraid of losing, we end up losing because we're our own worst enemy. You know, that is the irony of Saul's situation. We have to learn to give up control to the one who gave it to us in the first place. Entrust what God has given to us to him. I want to read to you Mark 8, 34 to 38. And it says, "When he had called the people to himself, with his disciples also, he said to them," this is Jesus, "whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful nation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. And then in John 12, 24 to 26, he says, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. And then in John 12, 24 to 26, he says, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. He who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternity. If anyone serves me, let him follow me. Where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. So if we hold on to this life so tightly that we aren't willing to give up our worldly ways, right, and do what God wants us to do, then we're going to lose our eternal life. That is the most important life. And so sometimes we are so worried about keeping the things that we want, the worldly things that matter to us. And God's like, if you're so worried about those things, you can keep those things, but they're going to die with you. But if you will worry about eternal things, about the things that matter to me, then you will live on. Then your life will be eternal. And so this is the paradox. We think that we need to hold on to all of these things because we're not going to get them back. But God's like, let go of the worldly things. They don't matter anyway. They're going to die. They're temporary. But the only thing that is eternal is me and the things that belong to me. And if you want eternal life, then you need to hold on to those things. And if you're so worried about all of the things that you have, that you're willing to sell your soul, you're willing to do anything to keep them like Saul was, then you're going to lose them. And not only that, but you're going to lose your whole soul. And so we have to be willing to entrust our lives to God and everything that he's given us, every good and perfect thing that we have in this world is from him. And so we have to be willing, even if it's good, we have to be willing to hold it in a loose hand and entrust it to the one who gave it to us in the first place. And only then will we truly be free to enjoy those gifts that God has given us, because we won't be burdened by, you know, trying to hold on to it. Saul was not happy, right? Saul was not at peace. He had no joy, and he ended up losing his family. He lost everything because he was worried about holding on to it. He made himself miserable because he was trying to hold on to something that he couldn't hold on to. And so the only way we're going to be able to enjoy what God has given us is to, you know, let it go. That is the way we get the freedom to enjoy the things that he's given to us. In 1 Corinthians 6, 19 to 20, it says, do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which is God's. You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Jesus gave his life for you. So what are you willing to give to him? Can you not give your life to him since he's given his life for you? I mean, that's the least we can do, right? And so God's given us everything. Be willing to give back to him. Don't be like Saul and be your own worst enemy. That's the lesson today. So Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. And then if you want this written lesson, go to livethroughjesus.substack.com and you can purchase these lessons for $6 a month or $60 a year. And then with this purchase, you also will receive access to all of the previous lessons that I've done, beginning in Deuteronomy with the Ten Commandments, and then finishing Deuteronomy, and then going on to Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel, Saul, and now David. And the great thing about digital studies is all of these scriptures are linked, so you can just click on them, and then you can change them to whatever version you want. You can read them right there on your device. And also, if you want to do this with a group, if you want to do a Bible study with a group of people and do one of these as your study, then this is the cheapest way to do it digital, because you don't have to each buy your own book. You can get one subscription and then just print out all of the materials. And it is a monthly subscription, so you're not just buying one book, but you can cancel at any point. And so you can just, you know, do it for a month or two or three or however long you want to continue to either do these studies for yourself or do multiple studies with a group. So that is one option. If you don't want this study to pay for, then still join Substack for free, because I also do a separate blog post with each one of these lessons, and that's totally free, and it's emailed to you just like the lessons are. The lessons will be emailed to you each week, and then you get access to the previous ones, and then you can, it's the same thing with the blog post, but they're free. And so you get one blog post sent to you whenever I finish each one of these lessons. And then you can also see all of the past blog posts. And then I also teach those blog posts on a separate YouTube and podcast channel called Live Through Jesus Weekly Devotions. And so I'd love for you to subscribe to that also, because you don't have to read them or anything. I just teach them, but it's much shorter because you're not going through the whole lesson. You're just getting the application part of it. So I hope that you will join me in one of those ways, you know, either at Substack as a free or a paid subscriber, or on YouTube as a subscriber on YouTube or podcast, so that you can continue to read the Bible with me and study and learn. Also, join me on social media at Live Through Jesus on all of the social media platforms. And then I'll just see you back next week. Thanks, and have a good day. Mm-hmm.